Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So as we speak here in Paris, the leaders of 31 countries are meeting about Ukraine to finalize their commitments, including potential peacekeeping measures there.
Yeah, French President Emmanuel Macron is positioning himself at the center of Europe's response, and that does seem to have helped his popularity ratings a little bit at home.
Specter of war will do that, I guess. Mm-hmm. Europe is trying to find ways to guarantee Ukraine's long-term security, help its defense capabilities without the United States, which under President Donald Trump is pulling away funding for Ukraine, also making overtures to Russia.
And the EU plans to rearm Europe. There's a 800 billion euro defense package on the table.
Yeah, and that's going to be interesting. It's a lot of money, given that France and other countries not exactly swimming in cash these days. France just passed an austerity budget, you'll remember, with cuts across all sectors, except for defense, of course. Are French people ready to tighten their belts while sending more arms to Ukraine? Who knows?
That is a big question. And there's also the question of where the money has gone.
Yeah.
Because the budget deficit, it turns out it's higher than was predicted. There's a report coming out next week to try and figure out exactly what happened.
So, Allison, wine, particularly in Bordeaux, is in trouble these days.
Oh, yeah. We've talked, haven't we, about shifting tastes in France.
Yeah.
People turning away from some of these rather heavy alcoholic wines from, for example, the southwest, where wines are getting even stronger due to climate change as summers heat up.
Yeah. And so people drinking less wine. Also, export markets sort of outside of France stalling. China's buying much less French wine than before. So what do markets do when they're having trouble? They look elsewhere, and interestingly these days, to Africa, France's former colonies and beyond. Our colleague Jan van der Mata met a woman in Bordeaux who's helping to make this happen.
Beer will always be number one because we are in a hot climate. People want something refreshing. But honestly, wine is getting there.
So Jan, tell us who this is.
Well, this is Chinedu Rita Rosa, wine consultant from Lagos in Nigeria. She is running a high-end wine consultancy in Bordeaux, the capital of the wine, called Vin de Rosa. She started with running a wine shop in Lagos until she moved to Bordeaux with a French husband in 2015. And she says there's definitely an increase in consumption of wine in Nigeria.
We have about 20% of wine being sold in Nigeria, and every year there's an increase. We're talking of wine in different forms. There is champagne, there's sparkling wine, there's cremo, and wine is really, it's not a struggling market for sure. It's getting up there.
Yeah, so Nigeria is one of Africa's top importers of sparkling wines and champagnes, according to the World Bank. And wine exports in general to Africa are on the rise, particularly from the Bordeaux region. Cote d'Ivoire imports more wine from the Bordeaux region than any other African country. Cameroon is not far behind. These are new markets for Bordeaux, as China's wine imports have been declining because of the economy, which is going down. For several years, there were like 190 chateaus, Chinese bought chateaus in the Bordeaux region, which were exporting their produce to China. And now many of them, because of the Chinese sluggish economy, they're stopping that. And now 50 at least are for sale for grab. And they stop producing. They don't make wine anymore. Chinedu told me that for years, even before the drop in the Chinese interest, she has been encouraging winemakers to think beyond that market.
10 years ago, when I moved here, I spoke to a lot of friends of mine in the wine industry. I said, would you people stop focusing on China? This was before the crisis in China. And then the same thing, I said, would you people stop focusing on only the US? All your marketing is going towards these places. Now it has happened that Mr. Donald Trump is in power and slapping a 200% tax is going to affect every winery. Now, we will have to start looking for new markets. And where's the new market everybody's running to? Three big markets: Brazil, Africa, India. Now, these are people or places that the Bordeaux wines might have ignored in the past. It can't be that way anymore. They have to embrace every market possible.
So Jan, this is a new market for Bordeaux, which, you know, is already very well known. This is the high end of French wine. Bordeaux, do they need to do any kind of marketing?
Well, it cannot count on the Bordeaux brand name to guarantee good sales. While Bordeaux complements some African dishes, Chinadou says that tastes vary, and she encourages winemakers or sellers to actually go there and meet their new clients in person.
You need to go, you need to meet the people, you need to learn the taste of the people. You need to meet the people, find out what the people like, because the client is, it's his taste you're looking for, not yours. But when you travel to Africa or you travel to Nigeria, you meet the people and then you kind of fine-tune yourself to their taste. It's not all about, oh, drink my wine is the best. No, it's no longer that. There's competition from Chile, from South Africa, from the US, from Italy, from Portugal. So what makes you different is actually doing the extra work of communicating to your clients.
Talking about adapting to local tastes, some wine exporters are looking at the development of alcohol-free wines by French winemakers as a promising way to get into the wine markets of Muslim African countries, which do not have a culture of drinking alcohol.
Right, right. Just like a way to get even more drinkers. So we're talking about a shift in mentality for winemakers. What's interesting, though, is we're talking about wine, which is really, you know, a quintessentially French product. It's being pushed in Africa, where France has historically played a role, like as a colonizer, you know, in many places in Africa, and at a time when relations are complicated.
And many former colonies have kicked out French military, like Mali, Burkina Faso, or Niger.
Yeah.
There's a rethinking of the relationship with France.
So are we looking at wine as, you know, either a way to restart the relationship or maybe to find new connections elsewhere in Africa, like in Nigeria? Like, what's going on?
Well, wine may prove to be a soft power tool to continue to have an influence, at least in this part of culture. But I mainly think that the problem is with the French wine industry. They are really suffering at the moment because of the American tariffs.
So they're sort of desperately looking for other markets.
And then the Chinese, as we discussed, and on top of that, there is a general trend that people drink less alcohol because it now is assumed by most of the professionals that one glass of red wine is not good for health, they used to say. So it's on all fronts it's going down. So they have to look for another place where to sell their products.
But it is, I just find it's really it is very striking that we're looking to a place where France, has historically been. The wine hasn't historically been there. Maybe a form of cultural colonization again.
Well, that's really her attack, because she doesn't only mention Africa, she also mentions India and Brazil as three markets which are not really explored yet by sort of greenfield operations for the French wine industry. They may have been discovered by other wine producing, maybe, of course, South Africa is very active in Africa itself. But what about Brazil, a huge country which she regards as a continent in itself? That's to be explored, and maybe there's some hope for the French wine industry to, get growing again.
So, Alison, do you play video games?
Sarah, I have not played one single video game in my life. I'm not saying I'm proud of that. I'm thinking maybe I should take one up in retirement.
Ah, there you go. I mean, interestingly, even with teenage kids.
I managed to avoid it. Strange but true.
I've played a few video games, but I'm definitely not a regular gamer. But it's massive here in France. Mm. Nearly half of French people play some kind of video game, according to the Culture Ministry. The industry itself says 70% of the population plays games. Over 38 million of us, apparently.
Wow, that's huge, isn't it? And video games are considered a bit of an art form nowadays, mm-hmm. just like literature or cinema. There are even subsidies for companies making them.
Yeah, France is one of Europe's biggest video game markets, and it also produces a lot of them, like Assassin's Creed. The latest installment, Shadows, came out last week.
Nous agissons dans l'ombre.
Pour servir la lumière.
Assassin's Creed is a big deal in the video game world. It's seen as one of the greatest single-player games ever. Here's someone who enjoys playing it.
Assassin's Creed is a game when you play alone. It's not like Fortnite or Valorant, or you play with other players. I like the characters and the cities, but I don't play a lot.
Ah, do you recognize this guy, Allison?
Yeah, I've got to come clean on this one. That's my 14-year-old, Louis.
Yes.
Yeah, he forgot to mention, by the way, he doesn't have the €80 to buy it, even if he wanted to.
Yeah. Well, you know, not yeah, easy for a 14-year-old. Well, yeah. Well, Assassin's Creed is made by Ubisoft, the French gaming giant that was founded 39 years ago this week, March 28th, 1986. It was founded by a group of five brothers from Brittany, Claude, Michel, Gérard, Christian, and Yves Guillemot. He's currently the company's CEO. And over four decades, it's grown huge, one of the world's biggest independent game studios, 18,000 employees and offices in 20 countries. The company started by reselling imported video games, quickly turned to developing their own. The first developer space was in a chateau in Brittany. They were hoping to attract developers that way. It grew quickly, and the company went public with an IPO in 1996, and it's kept growing.
And Assassin's Creed, the company's blockbuster, well, it first came out in 2007.
Yeah. It's a historical action game. The first one was set in the Crusades. The historical worlds are rendered in great detail. As a player, you wander through dense crowds, you leap from buildings, and you fight, of course. there followed a string of sequels, different places and historical time periods, you know, the Italian Renaissance, ancient Egypt.
And some people have said the mystery character running along the roofs of Paris during the Olympics opening ceremony, you remember, was a nod to Assassin's Creed Unity, the game set in Paris during the French Revolution.
Yeah. Last year, Ubisoft said the game has sold more than 200 million individual sales over the life of the series. Valhalla, the 12th in the series, released in 2020, was the first to make more than $1 billion in revenue. However, the company's run into trouble in recent years. In 2020, this was the start of the Me Too movement, shining a spotlight on the sexist side in the gaming world. French newspaper Libération broke the story of allegations from current and former Ubisoft employees complaining about toxic workplace environments full of sexual harassment and bullying. The company opened investigations, and several top staff members were sacked or resigned.
And a trial of three former executives is due to start here in June after postponements.
Yeah. So all this has made a stain on the company's reputation. In 2023, the company went on to a cost-cutting offensive, closed studios, 2,000 people were laid off. And then last year, several of its new releases bombed. Star Wars Outlaws and the latest Prince of Persia installment didn't do so well. It also released a shooter game meant to challenge Call of Duty called X-Defiant, which was shut down just after 6 months. Didn't do very well. So the company's share price has plummeted. And then French video game developers staged the first industry-wide strikes this February. 4,000 Ubisoft employees joined to protest against job cuts, against a drop in work conditions. Back in October, 1,000 employees went on strike to protest against changes to remote work policies, which, you know, is an issue across many industries these
days. They wanted more or less. I presume they wanted to keep.
They wanted to keep, whereas, where people are, you know, being encouraged to go back into the office. Anyway, all this has meant that Ubisoft is really hoping Assassin's Creed Shadows will do well and help it at least pull it out of its economic doldrums.
So this game is set in feudal Japan, right?
Yeah.
Some corners of the internet say that it took too many liberties with history by having, for example, a black samurai character who is actually based on an actual Afro samurai, by the way.
Yeah. It didn't go over well with those railing against diversity. They kind of had a field day with this. But early reviews from gamers have been positive about the game. The question is, will it be enough to save Ubisoft? We'll have to see.
Sarah, we're accustomed to saying, aren't we, that the French have a healthy attitude towards food.
Well, yeah, maybe compared to the U.S., probably there's less of a culture of fast food for sure, more structured meal times, and people do seem to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, better food at canteens, stuff like that in schools. Now, for decades, this has helped keep obesity rates down, but times are changing. The number of people classed as obese in France has doubled since 1997 and now stands at around 10 million. That's about 17% of the population. And a recent international scientific report published in The Lancet warned that if nothing is done, childhood obesity in particular could double again in the next 10 years. So obesity is obviously a big health concern. People suffering from it are far more likely to have chronic diseases such as diabetes and cancer. Obesity is now the fourth cause of mortality around the world. And in 1997, the World Health Organization declared obesity a chronic disease. A number of countries in Europe, Switzerland, Portugal, Italy and Germany have followed suit. And there are now calls for France to do the same.
So, right, we're talking an increase in obesity rates worldwide. This is a worldwide thing.
Yeah, it's closely linked to changes in society. People are eating more highly processed food that's higher in sugar, salt, saturated fat. And then there's the spread of screen culture and the fact that at least in the West, we're doing less manual work. And that means we're becoming increasingly sedentary. But beyond the health concerns, body size is viewed a bit differently around the world. Being big might even in some cultures be valued, but that is definitely not the case here in France. Here's sociologist Jean-François Amadieu, the author of a book, La Société du Paraître, The Society of Appearances.
La France est un pays où on valorise davantage la minceur.
France values thinness more than other countries. We reject and stigmatize a lot, he says. We don't like to see people putting on weight, especially women. It's a very French thing. You see it in international comparisons. The French are very hard on overweight people.
So this is what's known in French as grossophobie or fat phobia.
Yeah, and while discriminating against someone on the basis of their appearance in the workplace or during a job interview is an offence in France, it's quite hard to prove that unless the person has actually said something out loud about your size. Most of the time, the prejudice will be more insidious. And Sophie Joly has often been on the receiving end. She's written a book about it, Je n'ai pas choisi d'être grosse, I didn't choose to be fat, in which she recounts her experiences and she appeals for a better understanding of what living with obesity is like.
Vous êtes confronté à des employeurs qui veulent pas vous employer.
You're faced with employers who don't want to hire you because you don't meet their aesthetic expectations. There's a lot of discrimination in that area.
Quand j'étais étudiante, je devais avoir 5 ou 6 ans d'années d'études.
When I was a student, I went for a summer job in a supermarket. I got 5 or 6 years of higher education, and the shop manager, without even looking at me, asked me if I knew how to read and write. That's pretty humiliating. I said, hang on, you've got my CV. Have you read it? What's going on? She said, you don't fit in our shop at all, so thanks, goodbye.
Julie has managed to build a career as an architect, though she did tell me her boss preferred to keep her in the office whenever possible. The rejection of overweight people begins early, she says.
Au niveau des enfants dans les écoles et dans
For children in school or in higher education, it's terrible. They're bullied, particularly on social networks and at school.
Massacre. Il y a des TS.
It's a slaughterhouse. There are suicide attempts. It's intolerable.
Julie insists there are many different paths to becoming obese, no one. She already had a genetic predisposition and then she piled on the weight when she was a student. But also, growing up in a working class family in the north of France, where obesity rates are the highest, has had an impact on the way she came to see food.
Ben voilà, dans le nord de la France, on mangeait entre guillemets ce qu'on pouvait.
In the north of France, we ate what was available, and that meant the cheapest products. And in our low-income family, you didn't go on holiday or have the latest toy. On the other hand, I always heard my family say, well, we can't go on a holiday, but there'll always be something to eat on the table. So if we couldn't give pleasure through material things, well, the pleasure, the love, was provided through food.
She gradually gained weight over the years and then began the vicious circle of dieting.
Donc vous perdez 6 kilos. Vous en reprenez 10.
You lose 6 kilos, you put 10 back on. You lose 12, you put on 20. And your tissue cells remember that. So you enter this mechanical metabolic spiral, and after a while, it's irreversible.
She lost 70 kilos after going through bariatric surgery, getting her stomach stapled, but that led to complications. She had the staples removed, then she put the weight back on, then she had a ring fitted, she lost the weight again, but then when her breasts caved in, she had reconstructive surgery, but that she was then forced to have the implants removed when it was discovered that they contained substances that could cause cancer.
Right. This was the PIP-PIP scandal, the French implant company Polyimplant Prothèse that sold thousands of breast implants made from cheap industrial-grade silicone in the early 2000s.
Yeah, it really was a scandal, but many of the women did finally get compensation. Mm. At some point, Jolie said she wanted to have a child, so she stopped all those medical interventions, and her son was born when she was 44.
Wow, okay, quite an achievement. She's really been through it.
Yeah, she is indeed a very strong-willed and, as she says herself, stubborn woman, and she's determined to help others. In 2003, she set up the CNAO, the French Association for People Living with Obesity. They've been campaigning for a change in mentalities, for more goodwill, better prevention. A lot of progress has been made in the 25 years since she began campaigning. She points to recommendations, guidelines from the French Health Authority, best practices, that kind of thing, a presidential plan on obesity. There's a food charter that sets the framework for advertising. So overall, France has a strong regulatory base, she says, but it needs to go beyond that. Her association has come up with a series of recommendations, part of a report commissioned by the Ministry of Health, and they've called for obesity to be recognised as an illness. Jolie says this would be the best way to make sure that health professionals get the training they really need to be able to treat patients adequately. That's not the case at the moment.
Ils ne connaissent pas toute la fragilité qu'on a.
They don't know how fragile we are. For example, when you are obese and you have to go into the operating theatre, you have specific injection rates regarding the drugs to put you to sleep. But there are also dangers because people suffering from obesity have problems waking up after the operation. So recognising it as a disease would mean starting to educate health professionals so that we can protect ourselves. And also for a certain level of obesity, to be able to say to people, hang on, it's not all your fault. And that shouting at people isn't going to solve the problem.
So I guess this is a vicious cycle where people are blamed for being obese and not getting good care. So then they're less likely to go seek medical help and then the condition gets worse.
Yeah, and this is what's happening. And if doctors are guilt-tripping them, which some of them are, if clinics don't have, you know, the large examining tables or other adapted equipment, then they can't welcome obese patients in a dignified way. So you lose them. The CNAO is also calling for obesity to become the grand cause, or, you know, the major cause for 2026, and for the launch of a 10-year plan, a bit like the one we've had for cancer here in France, which has proven so very successful. Julie says this big plan has to be cross-ministerial, so not just health, but also education, transport, town planning, sport, and of course, agriculture.
Yeah, I guess food options are key here. The cheapest foods tend to be the highest in fats and sugar, and people with the least amount of money, that's what they're eating.
Yeah, and this is a major issue. Recently, there was a push by the agro industry to get rid of the Nutri-Score labeling system that we have here on packaged food.
Oh, right, those little visual scales that rate food A to E, telling you how much sugar, salt, and fat they contain.
Yeah, and the agro industry argued that this was undermining French produce, like high-fat cheeses and cured meats, you know, farmers very unhappy, etc. Partly under pressure from CNAO, the Nutri-Score system has been maintained, so that's a bit of a victory for Julie, but she still rails against all the sugar that we pile into foods here, even in things like canned peas, to get people hooked on sugar, which she says really is a drug. So they're lobbying for far more transparency on that.
So you said that she's tried diets, she's tried surgery. What about anti-obesity drugs, these sort of GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic? A lot of celebrities are now taking them.
Yeah, this really is the new frontier in treating the disease, Sarah. On average, people are able to lose more weight with these drugs than with, for example, a gastric band.
Yeah, I mean, it's been so successful that at least in the US, stocks regularly run out of these drugs.
Now, in France, the drugs are less widely available for weight loss. The drug Wegovy, has been authorized under very tight medical conditions since October last year. It's expensive, around €300 a month, and it isn't currently reimbursed by the state, so not really available to the majority of patients. Julie hasn't tried it yet, but says it is a game changer. The first people to try it in France were several thousand of the most seriously obese patients. They took it as part of a feasibility study that was run by the drug's Danish manufacturer. But when that study ended, Julie and the CNAO lobbied to have those involved continue to get the drug. The manufacturer has agreed to continue providing Wegovy to 3,000 of those most in need for another year. Now, obviously, if France does decide to recognise obesity as a disease, such drugs could get reimbursed, but we're not there yet.
So is there big support for, you know, considering obesity as a disease?
Minority of obese patients don't support the idea. They don't want to be seen as ill or officially labelled as disabled. The medical community also remains very divided on this issue, not least because, well, it will inevitably cost the state a lot of money and the health system is already out of pocket. Jolie argues, however, that it makes very good economic sense long term. The number of people becoming obese is set to rise. People with obesity are 4 to 8 times more likely to develop cancer. And that's going to cost the state far more in the long run. She points out that if you reduce your total weight by even 5%, you reduce your illnesses by a third. So the key, she says now, is trying to prevent people from becoming obese in the first place. And recognising obesity as a disease could help change mentalities, reduce stigmatisation, and therefore help with prevention.
We criticise what we don't know, what scares us, and then we reject what we don't want to be, what we don't want to see, or don't want to accept. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I've seen a mother capable of rejecting her child because he doesn't correspond to her ideal. The kid didn't ask for it.
So she told me more about that story. 10 years ago, she was at the nursery with her little boy. He was a few months old at the time. She found herself standing next to another mother who was also changing her baby son's clothes.
Et là, sans même me regarder, ni bonjour, ni rien, elle me dit,
without even looking at me or saying hello or anything, she said, how can you explain that your son is skinny when you're fat and I'm slim and my son is fat? I thought that was really violent and I said to myself, poor kid, it's not his fault and he's already getting it in the neck. I looked at her and I said, madam, I think your son needs love more than anything else. As for the rest, go and see a pediatrician. This is where it all starts. The mother, knowingly or unknowingly, is going to reject him. No cuddles, no affection, no attention. And what will he take refuge in? In whatever's around, whatever he swallows. It'll take on incredible proportions and he'll sink deeper and deeper into his problems and his mother will reject him more and more. If you don't explain things, you end up killing people, slowly but surely. It's not the child's fault. That's why I'm fighting, in my own small way, just trying to help 2 or 3 people in the process.
Aujourd'hui, on sait qu'il y a plus de 100 raisons d'être gros, mais ça dit toujours en premier, tu fais pas de sport et tu manges trop. C'est plus pratique d'être obsédé par le décompte des calories que par ce fléau qui s'appelle la grossophobie. Mais chut, on n'en parle pas, chut, ça ne se dit pas.
That's it for the show. Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International, RFI.
This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani. If you like the show, and if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please consider giving us a rating or a review. It does help get the word out about the show.
And if you want, why not send us a message? You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. You can also find photos and videos on the stories we've covered on our Instagram page, Spotlight on France, or find us online at rfienglish.com.
We'll be back in 2 weeks on Thursday, April the 10th. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah.